the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day out there taking over the world and having a great life as an entrepreneur. We have a fantastic show for you today. First up, we have Kenneth Pereira. He is from Brazil and is running an AI plus humans business. Absolutely fascinating. I can't wait to learn more about this. He calls it cognitive organizations, and it involves AI combined with humans to get the best of both. Absolutely great conversation, and I'm really excited to introduce Kenneth to you. After that, we are welcoming back Ali Horiat to the show. He is with Compassion Vist. He is the crazy guy who gave away $100 million because it was messing up his life. And we will let him explain and talk about what he is doing now and whether he regrets giving up the $100 million, all of that. Very fascinating conversation. We had him about a year ago, and so I'm excited to welcome him back. I think he was a great guest. And so there you go. I do want to apologize for the Ali Horiat interview. It doesn't sound very good. We used a new technology because he is overseas at the time. And so we used one of these new podcast platforms that are designed to make podcasting easier for everybody. And they're used by hundreds and thousands of podcasters, I assume. I did everything, I think, correctly and did it all the way that we're supposed to and everything. And it just doesn't sound as good. You know, I get complained at quite a bit for my technology. I am anti-Zoom, anti all of those platforms. We do our this show over the telephone, and people make fun of me all the time. Why aren't we using Zoom, or why aren't we using one of the other platforms? You know, they're designed to make this so much easier and yada, yada, yada. And then my show sounds better than everyone else's. And then everyone compliments, "Wow, your show is so clean." There's no, because we do it the old fashioned way and it actually works better. You know, the digital technology is digital, but that doesn't mean that your computer or the internet or all of the other things in between the two of you are going to be cooperating at that particular time. So just, I feel vindicated. Ha 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 ha. Anyway, also vindicate me, please, this way. Go buy my new book called The Real Environmentalist. It is being very well received. It comes out on the 30th, so 3 or 4 days from now. But you need to go ahead and get your order in now. The pre-orders are what counts double for the Amazon formula. And if we can get some pre-orders in now, it will appear higher on that first day. And so then supposedly it'll sell better, you know, yada, yada, yada. We have had considerable success already. The book has been number one in 3 different categories already and has hit some great sales numbers already. And I sure do appreciate that. And those of you who are out there helping, that is always appreciated. So thank you so much. And one more final thing. We are on Billionaire Alert. That's right. Billionaire Alert in the next 3 or 4 shows, 5 shows, I'm not going to tell you what, we will have a billionaire, and always fun to interview them and to get their insights and to hear the way they're thinking about simple things like the price of milk and all of that and how it affects them. So, Billionaire Alert, and we will get started in just a minute and be right back. Sell. Bye. We are back, and again, still very appreciative that you are with us. I'm very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome Kenneth Pereira to the show. He is author of a new book called Cognitive Organizations, leveraging the full power of generative AI and intelligent agents. He runs an organization. He is the CEO of 8020 Marketing and the CTO at another company as well. He is a two-time TEDx speaker and a professor in the MBA school at one of Brazil's top programs. Kenneth, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, Jim. I'm fine. Thank you very much for having me.
What is a cognitive organization? What does that mean?
So, Jim, I've been working with Emergent Tech for the past 15 years. And since generative AI, that's ChatGPT and all those tools, I like it, since it came about, I really felt, and I'm connection to the largest company operating in whole South America, that it's changing the way, the very fabric of how organizations organize themselves. I'm talking about the org chart, I'm talking about the processes, and I'm seeing that the combination between AI agents and human agents, so this is us plus technology, is really changing how business work. And then I had to name it. I think cognitive is a good word because not only we as human beings are cognitive beings, but also AI has cognition, has the ability to receive data, interpret it, and act on it as well. So the cognitive organization is an organization that combines AI and human agents.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, sure. So I've been working with companies all across different sectors, but I was working with this pharmaceutical company where they have to visit doctors in the doctor's office, and they have to recommend medications, and they have to give information to these doctors. Now, this company needs the sales representatives to be visiting doctors everywhere. So they are driving all day. Sometimes they have to be on waiting rooms inside hospitals, which of course during the pandemic is not very a good sight. And then when they needed to hire new people to work in this area, it's very hard to acquire talents in this area. It took them like 6 or 7 months to get those new salespeople ramped up. That means with the same level of cognitivity as the older people already working in the company. So we created this network of AI agents, which know everything about the medicine. So it studies all the documentation and watches every video and has contact with all the scientific papers and all that. And also another agent that connects to the BI, business intelligence dashboard and information. So now before this new sales rep visits a doctor, it can type this small message in a WhatsApp number and gets information exactly tailored to that rep, to that visit, to the very medication they have to recommend. So now this person has this co-pilot, it's a sales co-pilot, that summarizes data, that can assess the education forms and summarize it all, so the rep is able to ramp up in 3 weeks, not 6 months. You know, so this is the kind of organizational change that we're seeing in this pharmaceutical sector, for example.
All right, very good example. Thank you. And you're talking about this at the Fortune 500 level, right?
Yep.
Okay.
I'm talking about companies at every stage. Of course, a pharmaceutical company is a very large company, but I've seen small business as well, and especially because these generative AI tools are very inexpensive. They are wanting to have more and more customers. For $20 a month, you can get your hands on the best tech available out there. So something that works for companies in every sector and every size.
All right. So if I'm running a business and I'm interested in AI, how do I influence or integrate it into my small business? Say we're 7 employees, and maybe I'd like to use this to get rid of 2 of them. That's my ultimate goal. How do I make my business AI fluent?
Yeah. So the first thing is to get your hands dirty by using the tools. And again, I mentioned ChatGPT, but you can go for Google's Gemini or Microsoft's Copilot. You have Anthropic's Cloud. So there's a range of different tools you can use, but it's important to choose one and stick to it in the sense that There are people on the team, the seven people team in our example, that are the early adopters and they really like new tech and they get their hands and start using by the second. But now you have people on your group, on your team, that may be resistant to new tech, or they will create all this list of motives to not adopting the tech. So this is something that has to be, I'm trying not to use the word forced, but you have to repeat and insist that they will try to use the tool for every other task. I went to Harvard Business School, and they are using this framework called the WINS framework. So for any task inside your seven-people company that people work with words, images, numbers, and sounds, so that's where the WINS come from. If you're working with words, not only you're typing, but you're also reading, because AI tools help you read a lot faster, so you can gather a lot of information a lot faster with that. If you're working with images, I'm not talking only about creating PowerPoint presentations and then stock chart images, but also you can take photos of graphs and charts and tables when you don't understand the data, when you need to extract information quickly from that. So that's images. Numbers, of course, if you're crunching numbers on Microsoft Excel, if you're creating dashboards, those are all tasks that generative AI, and I'm talking about ChatGPT, Copilot, Gemini, any one of those are really good at tackling this kind of tools. And of course, sounds may be a little bit more specific, but especially words, images, and numbers, you got to choose one of those tools and put it on the hands of the employees and get them to work on it.
So the hard part, I think, Kenneth, is when you sit down, it's just a cursor blinking at you and you have to tell it what to do. So how do you give us advice on how to get started that first time? It's just a cursor blinking, 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 blinking. What do I do? I don't even know what to do.
Blinking. I get you, Jim. This is a very common feeling regarding the use of those tools. And I'll tell you that it's the first time I've been working with new tech, emerging tech for the past 30 years. And it's the first time that we have a tool that the tool itself can help you and instruct you on how to use it. I know it sounds strange. It's like a little bit metaphysical here. But if you have no idea what to do with the blinking cursor, you ask ChatGPT. So you tell it, hey, ChatGPT, I work in this services company and we're doing dry cleaning and we have to visit different companies. I want to know how ChatGPT can help me into my everyday daily tasks. So it's a good way to deal with this blank paper, blank document syndrome that you don't know how to start, is ask the tool itself. But always remember, Jim, we heard that ChatGPT knows it all. And sometimes we feel like it knows it all, but it doesn't. So it's very important for you to brief, very important for you to prompt. That's the word that they have been using for that.
All right. You know what? I want it to take that email and put it into a database with one button pushed. How do I do that? And then I think ChatGPT goes, oh, I can't do that. And then you're very frustrated, because that's what we all want, is some sort of integration between our email and our life. I bet that's the number one thing people want.
Yeah, definitely. And now you have to remember that we're talking about these big tech companies. They all have their own market. They all have their own solution. We try to call everything AI, but it's actually different solutions from different companies. So what I can tell you is, if you use Gmail like I do, I absolutely recommend you jump into Gemini, Google's Gemini, because Google Gemini integrates not only with your email, so if you needed to read your email, summarize your past conversations, but also connects with your calendar. So if you wanted to read your emails and set up an appointment in your calendar, it can do it for you. It also accesses Google Drive. Again, I'm not trying to promote Google here, but as a user, it's a tool that is really changing my productivity, everyday productivity, because it connects to Google Drive. So it can read my documents. It can access my presentations. I teach, again, at a business school, so it's very important to me to be handling and creating presentations all the time. So Google Gemini will maybe not be perfect. I think we're not in the stage that everything is flowing perfectly, but it's already a lot better than the old, good old fashioned way we've done it before, you know?
Yes. And what about, how do people learn to make process things, things that are repetitious and do the exact same input every day? How can we teach it to do that kind of thing?
Yeah. So we've talked in the first part of our conversation about the co-pilot, the idea that a tool aid you, help you out in your task. But there's another side of generative AI, which we call automation. So that's now when you get stuff, you get your tasks to be executed autonomously by a system. Now, maybe ChatGPT won't be enough as a tool for you to use, but there are other tools that you had to approach and learn. One of the largest ones is called N8N, N as Niagara, so N8N, one of the largest ones. And there's a new one I'm testing for the past 2 weeks. It's called Relay, relay.app. So those are two workflow AI tools. What I mean by workflow is you can really get a process that you were doing manually in the past, and then you can create those very same tasks that you, let's get back to our dry cleaning company. Let's say you have to map out the visits you have to make. So you get email from clients, then you get a map of the city, and you have the different addresses, and then you create this track, the fastest route for you to visit and not spend a lot of fuel, for example. You can map out these three steps and put it inside either N8N or Relay. And now you can automate it and execute it without the need for your interaction. It's a little bit more complex than talking to ChatGPT, which is amazing and easy and fast. But once you get a grip on the results of automating the drudgery, those tasks that were really not into executing that we had to, they must be done. Because now these tools, these automation workflow tools, they are able to look at the screen of your computer. They can browse databases, as you mentioned. They can use websites like Google Maps, for example, for the routes. So you can really pick every task you're doing manually and input it in that workflow.
So are people going to lose jobs? Are we going to have all of these thousands, millions of people losing their job because of all this?
You know, Jim, I have been hearing about people losing jobs since the 90s, in the sense that automation as a whole technology has been promising that for companies. I know that may sound like the dream of a board or the dream of a CEO and whatnot, but really, how I look at it, it seems like we're working more and more every year. So who is going to take my job? I'm still waiting for them to take my job, you know, in the sense that I'm doing more and more and more. But what I see from this topic is companies are actually having a harder time hiring. So this new generation is not as fond of to work as the previous one were. So they're working less. So now the problem that companies are facing is that they don't have enough talent. It's hard to get talent on board to work. So I don't see a lot of the let's fire everybody. I'm seeing more the let's hire, you know, discussion. So this is my, I don't know, finger on the pulse of the market as of right now. But of course, when we talk about automation, for example, for call centers, it's very easy to see that you can get a call center customer agent, customer assistant agent, to be automated in that sense. But remember, that very talent that is working in your customer assistance before, I'm pretty sure there's space and work for them as well. So that's how I like to look at it. The tech and AI is going to destroy all jobs.
All right. Well said. Tell us about Brazil and the entrepreneurial environment, the ecosystem there. Didn't you just put one of your presidents in jail for 30 years or something like that? So you have a Trump guy there too. Tell us about what's going on in Brazil.
Yeah, sure. So starting with technology and AI, what happens is China and the U.S. are fighting all over. It's what we call the space race of AI to see who is going to get to the moon first, right? So everybody has this new model and this new company creating all this amazing tech. But what I'm seeing is there is no other country but the U.S. and China that is even able to compete in that space. You don't see, for example, a European company. Where's Germany? Where's France? Where's the U.K.? Right? So it's only China and the U.S. They have the money, they have the human resources, and they have the energy to do that, some capital and energy to do that. But now, Brazil, and I can put India into that very same space. I was there two times last year. Those are countries that will work and fight in the application layer. What I mean by that is they're not developing the next ChatGPT, but they are using ChatGPT to help a real estate company. They're using ChatGPT to help out our large pharmaceutical company or our small services, dry cleaning services company. So those are, this is the money that's going to be made and it's already being made by companies either in India or Brazil. Now getting to the economical, political, political situation here. Yes, the former president was just condemned for 27 years, I think that's what happened. But the thing that we're worried the most here is not exactly this, because, of course, politics, and they like to talk a lot, and the current government is a left government, so they're trying to put everything on the right guy. But, of course, the guy from the right was doing the very same thing with them 4 years ago. So the current president of Brazil is actually a former convicted criminal. So it's strange, but it's politics. So they're tracing each other's tail. But what we're really worried is, of course, tariffs. Because the United States has imposed, President Trump has signed some very strong tariffs on some specific sectors. I have to say that he backed down. He has been backing down with lots of countries, and it's happened the same with Brazil. But for example, we produce a lot of sugar and ethanol from sugarcane. And this is a sector that he imposed really heavy tariffs. So we already have like more than 30,000 people were laid off because of the slowdown in the sector. So this is one of the sectors that's really feeling the tariffs. And the next one is, our access to technology just became a lot more expensive regarding the tariffs to China as well. So this is a very shaky time for us. It's definitely a very shaky time this September.
Yes, around the world, I think it's going to be interesting to see how the end of the year plays out and whether we have a good year or a negative year in terms of growth. So tell us about Data Neural, your AI consulting firm. This seems to me like anyone with a business card could be an AI consulting firm in today's world. And I think I've interviewed some of those people. Tell me about your business.
Yeah, sure. So my main company, this is a 16-year-old company, is 80/20 Marketing. So I have been developing a marketing and communication solution for just large customers. So, for example, I go on social media and then I capture mentions, people talking about some specific product or some specific company. So this is something that we do. We extract insights out of this data. Then we have the good old marketing plan. So media buying and content creation and SEO. So this is all we do with 80/20 Marketing. But since the generative AI revolution, I'm using the date of November 22nd, so we're almost 3 years into that revolution, that specific revolution. Since we have contact and a relationship with large companies, they started asking us for not only advice, but actually help them implement generative AI in their operations. So I felt the need to have a team that is more software coding and data oriented than the previous team I had with at A2N Marketing. So Data Neural is a really new company. It's 2 years and a half old, but already has some high profile clients, not only Brazilian, but also American companies, for example. We work with Mosaic, It's a larger fertilizer production in the world. They have a lot of mines here operating in Brazil. We do a lot of solutions for them, for example. And also Brazilian companies and European companies that need specifically tailored AI solutions for that.
Okay. And is it growing 100% a year?
Oh, possibly more than that. Yeah, because again, we are a mature company, so we do know what we want to do and what we don't want to do. So really with Data Neuro, we're only working with very large contracts. I'm talking total contract value up to $500,000. So it's grown a lot. Impressive. Yeah, definitely more than 100%. That's right.
Absolutely fascinating. Kenneth, how do we find out more, follow you online, get a copy of your book, learn more from you?
Yeah, sure. So you can find information of the book. The book's called Cognitive Organizations, and the website is cognitiveorganizations.com. So as easy as that. And I'm started creating content in English on X and Instagram. So you can find my name. My first part of my name is easy for an American. It's Kenneth, right? Kenneth. And the last name, which is a little bit harder, is Correa. Correa being Correa. Kenneth Correa. You can find me on Instagram and X. That's where I'm creating content in English.
Fantastic. Kenneth, thank you so much. And we'd love to have you back.
All right, Jim. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you for the great questions as well.
And we will be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one. You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
Back, and again, thank you so much for being with us. Very excited to introduce our first guest today. Boy, has he had an interesting career, and he's doing some things now that I think are going to make a difference in a lot of different spaces. He's active in so many different spaces. Please welcome Ali Horiat to the show. He is founder of CompassionVist. I think I said it close to being right. It is a profit-driven model. No. He left the profit-driven model to go out and worry about social impact, and that is what he is doing. The company's vision is to develop and invent ways to produce and consume more sustainably in order to have a sustainable living, but comfortable for all of us. Born in Dubai, attended schools around the world, got his education in Canada, multiple degrees, and author of 13 books. Incredibly impressive. Ali, welcome. How are you doing today?
Jim, thank you for having me, and I'm doing wonderful. Thank you.
All right. So the company, let's see if I can say it again, CompassionVist.
Perfect.
What does it do? Tell us about it.
So CompassionVist, let's start with the name. I came up with the idea when I was trying to bring compassion and activism together so that we can make a change in the world, we can progress and bring betterment to the world. So I put the words compassion and activism together, came up with CompassionVist. And the last E in the word is an ode to French, where you know you have gender roles assigned into the language. So a car is a female, for example,
right?
For those who don't speak French. But so I decided to make CompassionVist feminine in the ways that we should nurture compassion and that feminine power of love that is within each of us to bring together a sort of an essence of community and a social structure that can bring harmony to the world. So that was the essence of the idea. The goal of CompassionVist, it works as an octopus. So it's an ecosystem organism as an organization. And the idea here is, you know the thing about the octopus, it's got this big bulbous head with a brain in it, but then in each tentacle, it's got little brains within the tentacle. So when it says, hey, I'm hungry, I want to go out there and get some food, all the little brains function together as a collective to get food. So we've designed art programs, nutrition programs, a publishing house, a carbon labeling program, and multiple other programs to essentially bring that community wholesomely together to make the changes we need to make to affect the ways that we're living unsustainably today for an actual, truly sustainable future.
All right. When I think about sustainability, the last place that comes to mind is Dubai.
Mm-hmm. It is very true. And though I was born in Dubai...
are you there now? Where are you now?
No, we're based out of London, England. And I'm currently, right now, as we speak, in Dubai. I'm visiting my mom. She lives here. And we're based out of London, England. And we actually have a hub in California. We have a hub in Brazil. We have a hub in Africa, in Tanzania and Namibia. So we're spread around the world at the moment. But we are based and registered out of the UK. Dubai, as you say, is not, you know, you wouldn't be thinking sustainability when you think Dubai. But at the same time, remember, it's a small population. So targeting the market here is not the impact that will change the world. Targeting a market like the US, like India, like EU, essentially all of Europe, you are going to make changes in the people who produce the most pollution and cause the most unsustainable behavior.
All right. When your vision, what does it include? Does it include air conditioning?
My vision includes a spiritually sustainable decision making on a day-to-day basis in every action that we make. So it's not specific to where do you stand on every specific issue, but it's kind of an all-round approach to being healthier as a human and making healthier decisions in terms of the existential crisis that we're facing. So you may turn around and say, well, my thing is flying. I want everybody to stop flying. That is part of the sustainability. But if we stop all the flights in the world, as we know, it's less than 3% of the problem. Are we going to be sustainable by stopping flights? No. Are we going to be sustainable by stopping one tiny individual aspect of the problem? No. It has to be an overreaching element. So if you really want to discuss this in detail, we're talking energy. And the energy crisis is the biggest crisis that we have. It's 75% of the entire problem. A lot of people are talking garbage and recycling. That's only 4% of the problem. But what I try to bring to the table through the different programs is a holistic approach where people can start to make changes in their lives. You know, you say air conditioning, I say, sure. You know, if you're in a place like Dubai, for example, and you even have the wealth, it doesn't mean that you should just put your air conditioning at, 18 degrees Celsius because you want to feel as cold as you'd like to, or have a snow room in your house. That is unsustainable. But it also doesn't mean that you should chuck out your air conditioning and live in 55 degrees Celsius with 80% humidity. That's just also not feasible. So how do you pick the common ground? How do you approach this in a holistic way with all of the other decisions and choices that you make in your life to be the best version of yourself? That is what Compassivis brings.
All right. How do you focus on so many problems at once? You're dealing with the environment and social issues and animal rights issues and veganism and advocacy. You're doing so much. It seems like one of the things that we learn in business school is that an organization is better focusing on one thing.
Exactly. That's what you learn in business school. And I learned that as well in my MBA. But I threw all of that out the window because I went back into history and I remember the time when just because you were a doctor and you had an office to run didn't mean that profit maximization should be the priority of your office. So the human within us has to reappear in everything that we do. And when that human reappears, then that doctor who is focused on their office can now also be more conscious about the foods that they get in the supermarket. They can be more careful and more mindful about every choice that they make. So it's not really difficult when you look at it from a spiritual perspective as opposed to a specialized business perspective. So when you look at it from a specialized business perspective, you're thinking, hey, he runs a publishing house and he runs a carbon labeling program and he has a charity and. Well, first of all, it's not me. It's a whole collective of people in different parts of the octopus. Kind of like, think of Nike. Just because they're in basketball doesn't mean they can't be in tennis. And that's the philosophy we take. And being that it's all based on our human ability to put compassion first, it makes it easier to connect the dots.
Okay. So what does the model actually involve in terms of activity? So you're publishing. What, are you going out and looking for particular authors? You are dealing with the environment. Are you trying to get certain laws passed? What are the actual actions that you're doing now?
Okay. So you brought up the publishing. I'll start there. We are actively looking for authors, and we do have a few authors right now on our board. And what we're looking for is authors who want to be a part of our program to bring social impact stories to light, stories that you don't generally hear, stories that don't get published with mainstream top five publishers because they're not marketable. It's not the, Obama's life story or something like that. So it doesn't really get traction. We're looking for the things that really matter that don't get the traction. And then we're trying to push with the publishing house awareness. So right now you go into a bookstore, you buy a book, aside from the fact that the paper is going to be 89% illegally chopped down. First of all, that's the tree. Second of all, you're going to have issues of child labor involved in the binding of the books. You're going to have the pulp issues in the manufacturing of the books and many other things. Even a lot of the ones that are trying to present a sustainable version of them are really not sustainable. So we're challenging these different concepts. So the next time you go into a bookstore, you really think twice about whether the book you're buying, say your child, to educate them on certain things and give them a better educational perspective, is taking away from that perspective from another child as well. So how do we approach this? How do we advocate, and how do we activate against these problems? That's part of what the publishing house is doing, right alongside publishing authors that need to be heard. You go into the carbon labeling program as an activity, and what we're doing is, imagine Coca-Cola had a small label on it, just like it has its nutrition label and how many grams the can is and all of that, how many milliliters or liters the can holds. It also has a carbon label. It says, 52 grams of carbon for this can. And imagine now Pepsi comes around and says, ours is 42. Which one are you buying? Generally, with more education, the public's going to make the more sustainable choice. This creates competition, healthy competition, to reduce carbon footprints and spend more money in R&D to reduce those elements. So our carbon program is designed to label items so you can understand as a consumer what you're buying and how much you're spending. Every one of our programs is designed to healthily create a better, harmonious future. Then you get into the arts. So in our music program, for example, if you go back to the years where Live Aid concert happened and some other concerts for benefit happened, they made a huge impact around the world. The music did, people got involved, people became more aware with the situations they were dealing with. We want to revive that. We want music to be back into the social sphere for the causes it supports rather than for the money it makes. So there are people, musicians out there today that are making $100 to $1 billion revenues from tours that they're going on, but we're not seeing an attachment, a social connection of the tours to the places they're touring or to the causes they can be a part of. So we're trying to make our artists, nurture artists and collaborate with artists who care about not just the environment, but about, like you said, social issues, animal rights, other things that they care about, to purpose the music somehow to engage and activate and interact with their audiences, to create these concert spaces that reflect on the needs and the changes that we have to be a part of in society. And of course,
what is the carbon label for a Tesla?
So this is an actually interesting story and good question and good timing, because right before speaking with you, I was speaking with people about that program. And imagine presenting a driver in an electric car, the carbon output of the car, in the terms of, obviously, there's no emissions because it's an electric car, but the car is manufactured through the same steel and glass and rubber and elements and brake pads and stuff than, a combustion car. How do you factor that into the amount of driving that you're doing? How do you factor in the energy sources that you're receiving to fuel your battery, essentially, to, you know, get that battery up to run the motor again? We calculate that into the perspective of the car, and imagine within a few updates later, within that car, you can see your carbon footprint on the dashboard with all the other information that you have there. You can calculate where you're at. You can better yourself. You can say, you know what, even though it's a Tesla, half a mile that I have to walk somewhere, I could probably walk it instead of taking my car, and I could keep reducing that carbon footprint on a monthly basis, and the car will tell me I'm doing better and better, and I'm being more sustainable.
So, but does, when you calculate the carbon footprint of a Tesla, do you calculate the manufacturing process and the moving the batteries around? I've read a lot of really valid research that shows that the Tesla is actually worse for the environment than a gasoline car.
Yes.
When you add everything in, that the Tesla is worse.
You're right. And so this is not a black and white issue. This is how it works. If you get a Tesla for a logistic company, okay, and this thing is driving, hundreds of thousands of miles.
But it won't. It won't.
You're right. For the average consumer, which is why I said yes and no. So for the average consumer, you're absolutely right. If you buy yourself a small combustion engine, let's just say a Honda Civic with a 2-liter, 1.6-liter engine, right? And you're driving it rather carefully. You're not, you don't have a turbocharger attached to it, and you're not racing it. You're just driving it to work, and coming back or whatever to the grocery store. That is going to be the healthier choice, taken into account, especially if the manufacturer is going to give you a non-leather interior and other aspects that are more deteriorating in terms of the manufacturing cost of the carbon footprint. So you're absolutely right there when you make that judgment. Now, the idea here at Compassive East is to say, let's allow people through the carbon labeling program to really understand that education in the way that it can benefit the strides that they take. So right now, a lot of companies are going into the electric model. A lot of companies are saying, by a certain year, we're not going to have any more internal combustion cars. But are we making a mistake here? And the second question of this would be, is this a transitional period? So are we really moving to electric and sitting there and thinking this is better? And is this a political game? Or are we going to continue transitioning to solar and other systems where we can turn around and say, okay, this transitionary phase from diesel to solar is really, really, the way to go, and it was good. And even though we went through this electric phase that didn't really work too well, that's fine because we're through a transitionary phase. Now, that is where education comes into play. You say you've read a lot of valid articles. A lot of people say that. And a lot of people on both sides are talking about which one's better and which one's worse. To come up with a real figure and to understand this and to be able to compute this, we would need those carbon labeling numbers. I mean, we need to know as consumers, if I'm going to go buy a Chevy Cruze or a Honda Civic, I need to know from those corporations exactly what's going on in the manufacturing process and where, when I buy the car and it comes off the lot and I'm plating it, what carbon am I taking on for the whole production manufacturing process of this? And then when I drive it, what kind of numbers am I getting? I mean, we have a fuel gauge. It tells us, when we're near empty and we need to go and gas up. We need to have a carbon program in there to kind of continue this model. And then somebody driving a Tesla, somebody driving that Civic, 3 years down the road, we can come together again and we can say, hey, what are you at? And that person says, I'm at 36,000 grams of carbon. What are you at? I'm at 28,000. Oh, well, now we know which one's better, because we have the education as consumers. Right now, it's kind of all, let's throw the information out there. Some people will follow this trend. Some people will follow the other trend. And as you see, the Tesla trend is strong. I mean, the market share and everything else, not necessarily because it's the correct science, but necessarily because the marketing is well doing well. So how do we not buy into any sort of misinformation through education? And that's what we're trying to do with the carbon labeling program, kind of like the nutrition program on goods. You know, if you ask your grandparents whether those nutrition labels on any products, there wasn't. You went to the grocery store, you bought tomato paste, you really didn't know exactly what was in there. You just knew it was tomato paste. But today, you know exactly what's in there. That happened transitionally and gradually. I think we need that today, and that's what we're banking on. We're banking on providing corporations with the transparency of the label so that they can tell the consumer, here's your education to make the best decision and choice.
What's wrong with the leather seats? Talk to me about the impact of a beef-eating diet.
Okay. So, to start with the leather seats. I mean, leather seats, just like leather shoes, just like leather bags, leather everything else. The leather is generally not manufactured leather. It's a leather that comes off a back of an animal. Those animals are generally not, one animal hunted out in the wild. It's animals that are farmed and used for these specific reasons, given the numbers that we're working with. I mean, you know, there's X amount of cars in the world that you cannot fit leather seats on by just, trying to kill animals in the wild. So there's a problem there. There's something to talk about in terms of the compassion for the animals and the problem of how we're treating those animals because of the massive needs that we have today with overconsumption. That factors into the diets as well. One, now when we talk about these animals that are being farmed and all, if you go and do the research, I mean, it's very public, it's very open now. Much of the lands that we're using for agriculture is just for the grazing of these animals. And so we could be vegetating in those lands. We could be providing more foods at a cheaper rate so that people can have more access to food and not so expensive as it's becoming. And there's a huge inflation around the world with food prices, and it's just only going to get worse. So when you eliminate that sector of what we call food today, you are not only providing a greener environment through the vegetation, you're providing foods that are healthy, that are nutritional, that are the necessities of a human diet, essentially. And you are not engaging in the criminality of the way animals are treated today through factory farming. So it's a win-win across every aspect of it. The only problem is habit. We're a culture and a habit that has lived for a certain amount of decades and centuries on meat eating. And to kind of throw that away and change is not really easy for most people. And it takes some time and it takes some dedication to make those changes to, advance in the sense of the nutrition and also in the sense of the compassion for the animals and the rights of the animals, which are forgotten here. And for the environmental issue of having a sustainable planet, because we obviously would like to have the steak for many of us, but at the same time, do we want to see a world that's sustainable in 200 years? Or does it only matter that I eat the steak now and I don't care what happens after I die in a few years? So that is really the question that gets asked here with the animal rights program.
So I actually got hired about a month ago to write a book on the environment. And the thesis that I was given is that some people are doing great things for the environment. The book is about a guy named Wayne who has, for the last 20 years, spent $20 million of his own money worrying about and figuring out how to recycle lithium batteries. Mm-hmm. And he's made more progress than anyone else in recycling lithium than I know of. I can't find anyone who's made more progress than him. But no one in the world knows who he is. He's a complete unknown. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we have Leonardo DiCaprio, who is considered one of the great environmentalists of all time. And you find him flying Well, let me finish. You find him flying from one super yacht to the next super yacht with whatever 22-year-old he's dating at the time, It seems to me that he's the worst environmentalist out there. I can't find any pictures of him actually planting a tree or anything. The only thing he does is talk at the UN and then gets on a private plane and flies to his private yacht. I don't think that he's an environmentalist at all. I think he's part of the huge problem. What are your thoughts on my book?
100%. I would actually publish that book. And you know what? I'll tell you something. Many years ago, before I got into any of this, and I was in finance, and I was the Leonardo DiCaprio, you know? I wasn't as good looking as him, but I was living that life. And I came across a film by Woody Harrelson. Woody Harrelson was involved in it. And it's called Kiss the Ground. And it really opens your eyes and perspective on, you know, agriculture and sustainability and changes we need and how he was promoting it and how after the movie finished, you could actually click on a link or take down the website at the theater if you were and go and continue this conversation and help. And it changed a lot of farmers' lives in the United States and the ways that they were, you know, farming. That to me is the kind of activism that somebody at that level should be doing. If you're going to make a film, Don't Look Up, and then, like you said, you know, you're jet-setting around the world, I don't know if you're living by the values that you're promoting. But then somebody like him turns around and says, I'm not an environmentalist. I never said I am. I'm just, this is my day job. That's all I do, you know. That's what I do for a day job. I get paid a lot of money to come on different stages and say those specific words and scripts that they throw at me because, you know, I'm a celebrity, and that's what I do. I really don't care. But that's the image that we throw out there, and it's our fault. It's not his fault. It's all our fault. So we shouldn't be kind of looking at him and saying, you're a bad person. No, it's kind of like looking at Nestle and saying, you're a bad company. No, you're not a bad company. You're just giving us what we're demanding. So if I stop buying plastic bottles of water, you're not going to make plastic bottles of water. You didn't come into this market as Nestle and said, our model is to destroy the earth with plastics. No. They came into the model saying, we want to make the most profit by supplying at the cheapest point what the public asked for. The public is asking for Leonardo DiCaprio. The public is asking for Nestle. They are milking what the public is asking for. Let's stop asking for it, and Wayne will be famous because we will start talking about Wayne. We will start bringing Wayne into the sphere. We will start telling Wayne, how much more money do you need, Wayne, to make the differences that you really need to make, and how much faster can we make it as a collective? That's what Compassivist is about. It's about finding the Waynes of the world and saying, join Compassivist, let's grow this model to millions of people who can now follow this account instead of following, you know, the ones who are just acting it out.
Very interesting. Ali, we've run out of time. I could talk to you for ages. We haven't even gotten into religion and some of the other stuff yet, but we are out of time. How do we find out more, join the cause, and learn more about what you're doing, please?
Compassivist.com. It's easy. And because it's a unique name, all our social handles are at Compassivist, so you can go there. My email, ali@compassivist.com. You can shoot me an email, get in touch with me, and, you know, we're really looking forward to making a change. We're putting all our eggs in a basket. That basket is the Compassicon, which is the Compassivist convention, which is launching in September of 2025, in about a year from now. And we're not really big on the, like, you know, you hit the nail on the head. We're not big on the social media stuff and promoting ourselves and then living a different life. We're trying to do what Wayne was doing and is doing, in the sense of really putting our work ahead of us. So the convention is going to be where we're going to launch all our programs and show the world what we're about. Follow us, engage with us, interact with us to get more information, and let's all do this together. It's about time we change it.
Ali, thank you so very much for being with us. Great story, great information, and I love what you're doing. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jim.
We are out of time. Thanks for being with us. Take care. Have a great day. Bye now.